Yes, thank you. Good evening, everybody. I am very happy to be here. This is a subject that I've talked about for about 25 years now, and it's described in my life in many ways. And it's not the subject of climate change, however, although I think that climate change is its leading and most spectacular and most immediately destructive and most globally active process. Okay, sure.
Sorry.
Is that better?
Yes.
Yeah, is that better? Am I hearing, you hear me up in the back? Yes? Okay, good. but at the risk of being sort of out of step, I do want to say something that's very basic here, which is that I would urge us not to become fixated on the question of climate change, which does not mean ignore the question of climate change, but rather perceive it and deal with it in the context of the totality of what's going on in this historical moment. So you can just imagine to yourself, are there not processes somewhat akin to climate change, and they have to do with the destabilization of nature or ecologies, if you might want to say that, which are not in themselves climate change, although they actually interact with it, but have also very, very deleterious effects, so that if you take a thought experiment, which is ridiculous on the face of it, but nonetheless for analytic purposes, and say, well, let's say by some sort of a miracle, the atmosphere re-equilibrates itself, something happens, some fantastic technological fix, which will not happen, but in any case, will we be all right? And the answer is, of course not. We won't be at all right, and if we had enough time, I could go around the group and I could ask you to think of those processes which are, as I say, analytically akin to climate change in that they involve the things coming out of joint, the Earth's ecosystems falling apart in some way or other, and yet are not immediately climate change, although obviously interact with that. Think, for instance, of honeybee deaths. Think of all of the species that are going under. Just think of the pollinators. What would happen if all the pollinators go under? Now, obviously, climate change is a problem there, but so is habitat destruction. So is pollution. So are pesticides. You follow that? It's logically wrong to isolate climate change as though that were the singular issue. And we can take it, other steps. We can see, look at these plastic bottles. I don't want to be, sort of rude here, but so many times I go to an ecological event and they hand you a plastic bottle.
Not me.
Not you. Oh, yeah, well, good for you. I didn't bring my. I know New York City has a great water supply. Do you know about the floating continent of plastic bottles in the Pacific Ocean? Do you know about the debris that ends up in the oceans? It's microscopic, some of it. It's in all of the fish. It's fibers from clothing that swept down the toilet, and so forth. We shouldn't be. I have to have water, but we shouldn't have plastic bottles. And that's not climate change. So the question is, we have an ecological crisis, and the ecological crisis means that somehow civilization has so acted as to bring about a fundamental and possibly irreversible breakdown in the natural, and that's a hard word to define, but we don't have the time right now, in the natural firmament in what we live on and from and with and are made from. So, and I say made from also because you know that the average pregnant woman as she comes to childbirth, is carrying in her blood serum about 50 alien substances which are very harmful to her or the fetus. Okay. So you can get a sense that we are engaged in something of which climate change is the most flamboyant, if you like, manifestation. But that the basic issue here is what is afoot in the world as a whole, and you have to step back a little bit. And I think analytically, you can say that there's only one effective cause of all this, and there are ultimate causes, maybe we might say, but one cause that puts it all into action, and that is the global capitalist system. Now, stepping back from that, I want to say that the capitalist system itself is very poorly theorized in most of the left discourses. People talk a lot about it, or they say system change. But the capitalist system, what is meant by the capitalist system? What has to be changed? I see very little effort to understand what this entity is. And of course, to do that would require many hours of historical reflection. We can maybe return to some of that. But I want to say in a very cursory fashion that what we're looking at here is what happens to a class society, which is, of course, not innate to humanity. And since humanity came into being as a communist society, and that for various reasons, some of them having to do with gender and other factors, class arose. And at some point in the history of class societies, they were, the ruling classes realized that by taking into account the money that was developed in the exchange of commodities that were produced by the classes, you could develop a much more vital, if you know, or at least powerful form of class society. And that brings you into capitalism. The system of capitalism occurs when money enters into class relations and into productive relations. And I want to step back a little bit again, because it's only a few minutes here. And
two minutes,
impossible, okay? But let me just say what I can for 2 minutes. Capitalism is not a system as such. That system is too abstract. It's not an economy, okay? It is, and this is the relevant term here, it is a mode of production, because production is the human species-specific way of expressing ourselves. Production means we have something called conscious transformative activity or labor, and that acts on something else to make something, including making oneself. And that can be expanded into the entire panoply of history, of religions, of artistic expressions, and the like. Capitalism exists because once the money term takes over, it advances a certain form of economy, and which form of economy is crisis-ridden, and at a certain point, although it goes way back, you can start seeing so destabilizes because the natural firmament, because of an inherent trait which was not found in any other form of economy that human beings had up to the origins of capitalism, and that is an eternal impulse to expand, a restlessness, an inability to establish limits. And that has something to do with money, because money has no limit. It's a number. So it's detachable from reality, and also gets you into the expansion without end. And at a certain point, because it's also crisis-ridden, you begin seeing these weird phenomena, and now we are in the process of being on the brink of just being destroyed by them. Okay? But the way out is to transform the mode of production, or rather, the mode of production will transform itself, because we've had a series of modes of production. But whether the next one is annihilation of capitalism by its own devices, or whether it's some vital and vibrant replacement. That's the question before us.
I'm going to have to ask you.
Yeah, I just want to add one word, yeah. And that is the word for that vital transformation is eco-socialism. It's a form of socialism where the element of nature becomes fully embodied as against simply the element of labor. Much, much more can be said about this. I hope I have the chance to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Just for future reference, I'll give a knock at 2 minutes.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming out on this rainy night. Thank you to Platypus for organizing this. I'm going to put on my watch here so I can see it. So, I mean, the way I approach this is, the questions were helpful in thinking about this, but this is the way I approach the question of climate science, that we have to begin with the science, the question of climate change. We have to begin with the science. And in terms of like what in the left tradition is helpful, well, that's one of them, and that's a key part of a large part of the left tradition, at least of classical Marxism, is to take science very seriously. If we do that, there are implications for politics. And the science around climate change is pretty clear, that the Earth system has tipping points. The Earth climate system has tipping points, that the causes can build up and then the effects kick in later. And this has been demonstrated pretty well by climate science. The history of the climate reveals this. This was a kind of, you know, obscure, or this was a marginal idea in the 80s. It's now accepted because you can see these sudden shifts in the climate regime in the ancient climate record. So it seems that 350 parts per million of CO2 is the danger line. We're well beyond that. We're at 405 parts per million. So we're into the zone where the whole climate system can seriously unravel. And, you know, it probably will. I mean, all indications are that that's what's going to happen. But if we take that climate science seriously, that means we have a very, very compressed time frame to deal with this problem. And I, as a socialist, as a Marxist, don't think it is credible to propose changing all of social relations so as to change how we get energy. I don't think that can happen in the 20 years left. Also, the record of socialism is it's easy to dismiss, and I think that's one of the problems that the left has with this. We dismiss the actual record of socialism rather than trying to own it and explain it and think about why that is. And the fact of the matter is that socialism, in its various forms, from the Soviet Union to, you know, the kind of, you know, managed capitalism of Evo Morales and Garcia Linares, you know, they're talking about a 50 to 100 year time frame for getting to socialism in Bolivia. Well, whatever the case, I mean, these political experiments, their record in terms of getting off of fossil fuels, not so good. So there's no guarantee that addressing property relations actually decarbonize the economy. So I see decarbonization as actually something that can be done separately. Now, because climate change, the implications of it are so totally apocalyptic, it is easy to conflate it with the larger impending ecological apocalypse that Joel described. And I totally agree with his description of that and his analysis of it, that this is fundamentally about capitalism, about the value form. But I don't think that we have the time to deal with all that so as to deal with this one problem. But people, I think, confuse climate change with all these other problems. And actually, I see climate change as one subset. And if capitalism could be forced to deal with climate change, to decarbonize, to shift to clean energy, it would not involve or equal a reconciliation with nature, quote unquote. It would merely be a way of buying time to deal with all of the other problems. So again, it's like, yeah, I think you have to decide whether you take the climate science seriously or not. And if you do, you're forced to deal with reformist politics. Now, if you're willing to do that, I think there's a lot at hand for activists that has not been utilized. We have much of what we need to address this problem. And in thinking about this, I also draw a distinction between capital, right, the logic, value in motion, versus capitalism, the entire society that capital dominates, but is made up of other institutions as well, including a very large and robust public sector. You could make a case that capitalism is actually quite dependent on a kind of shadow socialism, which is the government. So capitalism as a whole, capitalist society, has to decarbonize or we're done. Can capital do that? No, I don't think capital on its own can do it. But we have what we need in many ways, which is, even here in the United States, which is one of the most, probably the most recalcitrant country in the world in terms of dealing with this, we already have the laws we need, we have tons of money, and we have the technology. The laws we need are the Clean Air Act, as modified by a lawsuit, Massachusetts versus EPA, which in 2007 said that the EPA has to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and we've been waiting for a series of tailoring rules for the better part of 8 years. We've finally gotten one or two rules out of the Obama administration, but the environmental left has been busy with, you know, divestment, this, that, the other thing, rather than demanding action from the government on these existing laws. We lost 2 years, everybody trying to campaign around comprehensive climate legislation, which was never gonna pass the House and Senate, when we already had these laws, which have been overlooked. So if we had been strategizing about how to pressure the EPA to do its job, I think we would be making much more progress than we are. There's tons of money. The government spends enormous amounts of money on energy and vehicles. If we made demands that the government buy clean technology and clean energy, that would create economies of scale in a very short time that would help mobilize private sector money to go into building out a clean energy sector. There is enormous amounts of uninvested capital. That is the core problem that capitalism always faces, right? The overaccumulation. And currently, corporate America is sitting on about $5 trillion of cash that is parked in short-term, low-yield safe assets. This is not money distributed to shareholders or put out as bonuses. This is money retained by firms for investment. With the right coercion, the right policy environment, private capital would help invest and build out this new energy sector. So the government can consume energy, and it can use the existing laws to force capital to help invest in producing that energy. The federal government, just so you have a sense of what I'm talking about, I mean, the public sector is about over a third of the U.S. economy, and a lot of that is wages. It's not all buying energy and cars and stuff like that, but the post office alone has about 140,000 vehicles, all of which pretty much travel 18 miles a day and park in the same place every night. No reason they can't be electrified. If those kinds of things were done, you would see a shift towards clean technology. And we know this is true because that's, in fact, the only way that technology ever comes to scale under capitalism. All of this, the iPhone, Maria Mazzucato has a great book in which she illustrates how there are 12 different publicly funded technologies in the iPhone that, once they're finally proven and brought to scale, are then licensed to the private sector. From railroads to airplanes, again and again and again in the history of capitalism, you see that the state doesn't just pay for R&D. The state is the first consumer. The state is a subsidizer. It drives technological change. So we have to see that and demand and craft strategies around that, and then make demands of the appropriate parties, which I think is involves targeting key officials and personnel. So, I'm out of my league here. I'm not a movement strategist, but I was very impressed by the movement to defend net neutrality. And, how did those activists do that? They didn't boycott AT&T. They didn't try to divest from, Comcast or whatever. They went to the head of the FCC's house and sat in his driveway and wouldn't let him go to work. They camped in front of the FCC. They made these officials, they made their names public, and then they dragged them through the mud. And what did those officials do? They did a 180. They completely reversed their position, and they protected net neutrality. So, and then another key thing that the environmental left should be demanding of the state in terms of the assets we have at hand is also the use of public lands. 25% of all fossil fuels are sourced from public lands. So that's the first subsidy that has to be pulled away. So now, if a strategy like this were pursued, if it were effective, and we could basically, force the price of dirty energy up and the price of clean energy down, and force a shift in global capitalism away from fossil fuels to solar energy, broadly defined, and you could imagine how developing economies would leapfrog, as they did with cell phones, leapfrog whole stages of technological development, not building electrical grids connected to solar plants, having distributed solar power. I mean, all that is totally possible, and in fact, in many places already happening. You could see how we could avert not climate change because we're locked in for 3-foot sea level rise. We're locked in for bad stuff. But we could avert runaway catastrophic climate change, which is self-compounding. And if you don't know about that, read James Hansen's book, read that the chapter on the Venus syndrome. He may or may not be right about that because you know, it's not clear that the planet would necessarily heat up to the point where all life on Earth dies and the oceans boil off, because some of these feedback loops have a limited, you know, time frame. But the Earth absorbs more and more heat as the polar ice melts, but then of course once all the polar ice is gone, that rate of increase of heating stops. So there might be reason to doubt some of that. But whatever the case, the point being that I think it is in fact possible to get capitalism, to force capital to move off of fossil fuels, and it requires the state being pressured by movements to inhabit the role that it has always had, which is really as the guide and master of capital. If we did that, it would not solve the problem that Joel described, but it would give us time to deal with some of that.
Do you want to pull that thing up, and I'll just flag you? And so, I'm a historian, and you know, Marx famously said that people make their own history, but not in the conditions of their own choosing. And I think that, you know, climate change is certainly not the condition of, you know, of our own choosing. But what I want to do today is really to talk about some of the structures that have become embedded in American society. And I'm an American historian, that's what I know best, since about the end of World War II, that I frequently see kind of writings on the left about climate change neglect to talk about, and to talk about the kind of the built environment and infrastructural challenges that must be surmounted. I totally agree with Christian that avoiding cataclysm is the goal right now. I mean, avoiding, you know, kind of mass death and apocalypse, which is what is on the table. And I think that probably does require engagement with, you know, with reformist politics. But avoiding this kind of the slow moving cataclysm that will unfold over the next century requires, I think, a usable past and some stories about how it is that we got to this point, and starting with what people have called the Great Acceleration. You know, and I think, you know, it requires a usable past that's going to, you know, illustrate what policies and the ideologies helped create this moment, what structures it created, and to suggest what the justice part of climate justice might look like. So I think we need to date the current.
Andrew, could you speak a little bit more?
Sure. I think we need to date the current moment of climate change not to the rise of neoliberalism. I think that's a hugely misguided target. I think we need to date it to the high age of Keynesianism, and, you know, and to the beginning of the Great Acceleration in the 1950s. And, you know, I think that the American version of Keynesianism, what people call growth liberalism, is by and large to blame for climate change to an extent that people haven't talked about. This is growth driven by consumption, you know, that you see in ads, you know, like this, that relate energy use to kind of family togetherness, energy use to the good life. You can show the next one. Some of these are obviously corporate driven. Here's Ronald Reagan when he was a GM spokesman, you know, kind of promoting all of the different products GM offered. It's also, though, a result of deliberate policies, federal subsidies to build new homes, changes to banking policy that encourage large amounts of consumer debt, both for homes and for durable appliances like these.
And automobiles.
Yeah, automobiles. Climate change is a result of state policy. You know, it's not an intended result of state policy, but it's a direct outgrowth of, you know, the state policy to promote kind of mass consumption fueled growth. This was accompanied by other elements of growth liberalism that attempted to spread this vision worldwide. The U.S. military, the development infrastructure that created this kind of notion as the idea of a good life. And these energy demands have been baked into a system of economic growth that's reigned since World War II. And it's created a durable built environment of low density houses, auto dependent development. In much of the US, that's emulated in much of the world. If you look at auto ownership rates in China, it's, you know, you see this rapid, you know, transition based on an idea of what, you know, of what modernity looks like. So climate changes a lot, but one thing it doesn't change is the infrastructure that, and the environment that's already been built. And I think we need to work, you know, we need to have a very kind of clear-eyed view of how much the built environment that exists in much of the nation, you know, is a driver of climate change, and to think seriously about ways, you know, that can be mitigated. Go ahead to the next one. The second reality is the reality that kind of modern America is a coal-fueled nation. You know, we like to think of coal as this, you know, thing that was, you know, in kind of 19th century Manchester, kind of the U.S. is a coal-fueled, you know, nation. We're down now to 39%. At its height, we were 48% of electrical production coming from coal. Very few of us who live in places like New York see coal, and it's because of this. This is the system by which coal is brought to American consumers, by and large. It's a system that people in the 50s called coal by wire. So the transformation of coal into electricity at the mouths of mines that are then shipped long, long distances to consumers who never see the costs of their consumption. Metropolitan areas get this kind of implicit promise of brownless energy without the smoke and ash piles that existed where coal was produced. I think that this is, and another thing that it produced, go ahead, Pam. So this is Four Corners Power Plant, which is the largest, was the largest polluting power plant in North America at one point. It was one of two things to be able to see by the Apollo astronauts, Great Wall of China and the plume from Four Corners.
Wow. What about the salt and sea?
Salt and sea is kind of man-made. But it looks in an infrastructure like this. Go ahead, Pam. This is what the electrical grid looks like in the Southwest that I'm most familiar with. So you get the cities here on the edges. You can see Phoenix is down here, Tucson, LA, and all the power plants at the center on the Navajo Nation, largely Native American landscape that most metropolitan residents never see. There's actually an opportunity here for green energy. This is a grid that exists. This is a grid that is built, but this is also a grid that has space for green energy to be built into it. There's a Navajo environmental group called Dine Care that's proposed a renewable energy plan for the Navajo Nation that would rectify many of the problems of coal by replacing coal-fired power plants with large-scale solar and wind farms. Those are obviously not, you know, a large-scale solar farm has environmental dilemmas. A large-scale wind farm has environmental dilemmas. They're dilemmas that I think avoid the cataclysm of kind of planetary death, which is what we're looking at. Finally, and this kind of goes along with this, the way that most Americans get their energy exists in a system of spatial inequality that I think you see well on this map. My friend Eric Loomis has a great book called Out of Sight. That's about the way that corporations export catastrophe, and I think part of the mission of people engaged in climate change is both to attempt to mitigate kind of planetary catastrophe, but it's also to make evident the costs that have been borne by people with some of the least social power, you know, in this country and around the world to provide energy. So that's a way that kind of Navajo activists in the late 60s imagined this new system. And here's a map, Pam. That's some protesting, and I think it's telling that the climate justice movement has been largely initiated by indigenous activists who, you know, are working for kind of, you know, the protection of place rather than the protection of the planet to start with. But here's a map of all the coal-fired power plants in the U.S. And you'll notice some of the spatial dimensions of these. Some of them are located near cities, but most of them are located in places like northern Arizona and New Mexico, the huge belt you see in West Virginia, eastern Kentucky. These are people for whom the left, I think, needs to think seriously about what the solution is for people that live in these places. Indigenous activists have been protesting, you know, coal plants for a long time, in part because, you know, they reflect, I think, better than many things, the colonialism that characterizes American society. In places like, you know, West Virginia and eastern Kentucky, people aren't as used to thinking about colonialism and themselves as colonized subjects. But these are people that are going to suffer tremendous, tremendous economic dislocation by the response to climate change. And I think the left needs to kind of think about what this, you know, what the response is, what justice looks like for people who live in coal-dependent areas as, you know, the ways that they've made, you know, meager, you know, desperate, but still livelihoods attached to specific places goes away. And, you know, I think that that needs to be, you know, I think that kind of, you know, mission for seeking justice in the system that's been set up and created at the same time that, that, you know, the real cataclysm of climate change is, you know, is mitigated to whatever extent it can be, have to be kind of paired missions. I'll leave it at that.
I'm not used to speak with microphones. So first I want to thank Pam and the organizers for giving me the opportunity to put a socialist alternative position in this panel. And I want to start with a kind of an anecdote. I was listening the other day to this podcast in the radio, and the hosts were interviewing this guy that owns a recycling plant in Brooklyn. And he was complaining about the difficulties of keeping the business open nowadays. Apparently, because the euro has gone down, now China, that is the main country recycling, prefers to buy products to be recycled to Europe instead of the United States. And even more, he was also explaining how there are certain products, like plastic bags, for instance, that because the price of the oil has gone down, right now for China it's better to produce new plastic that actually recycle the one in the plastic bags. So the guy was basically throwing as garbage all these plastic bags. Yeah, and I think that this really summarizes the problem that we are facing here, right? We have the technology, we have the capability, but we are not applying it in the sake of the markets. And today, as my pals in the panel have said, we have at least 97% of the scientists worldwide that agree that climate change has human causes, right? They are telling us that we have to really shift away from fossil energy. We are witnessing right now the effects of climate change in Sandy, in Katrina, in growing earthquakes in Oklahoma due to fracking. We are seeing rising sea levels every year. Every year that we pass, we break the record of the hottest. And the reality is that on the face of this undeniable crisis, our politicians, the ones that are supposed to represent us, they cannot offer anything else than market solutions, right? Solutions that, you name it, from carbon tax to cap and trade to nuclear energy, all of them are unnecessary weak and will take unnecessary long time. In 2009, there was this research published about how to plan the world with 100% renewable energy by 2030. We have the technology and the knowledge, but the reality is like we don't apply it because the big oil companies in this country that are the largest on the United States economy control our political system. And those companies benefit from keeping the status quo. Those companies benefit from keeping burning fossil fuels. And it's not only that, but even more, we have already factored into the share prices of these companies 5 times more carbon that could be safe to burn, to keep in safe conditions. And that means that every corporation, every business that owns stocks from these big oil companies needs to keep burning fuel, fossil fuel, in order to keep their profits. And I think that that's why every international agreement to seriously cut carbon emissions, it's effectively blocked. In climate conference and after climate conference, we are seeing this. It's there is no world leader that would be able to really agree to an agreement to cut carbon emissions if this is going to put them in a disadvantage with other countries. And I think that this is what the left should be pointing to. This is not a single problem, it's a systemic problem, a problem of the way that we are producing. It's not a question of you and me taking the train or the car to go to work. It's been calculated that 90 companies are responsible for 2/3 of the carbon emissions since the Industrial Revolution. It is not a problem of how many humans live in the planet. We are producing 1.5 times more food than would be necessary to feed us all. The problem is how, in the society, we are deciding what, when, and how do we produce and consume. Who can decide where my energy is coming from? Who can decide to build in a plan of solar cells in my cell phone so I have to change it every 2 years? The problem is a balance of forces. In this for-profit system that is based on private ownership, cannot take us forward, cannot take us forward by its own. There is no motivation in the short term for a start driving away from fossil fuels. And I think that that's what the left should point at. And what this means is that we need to build movements, movements independently of the 1% of all this capitalist class, of all these big companies that are benefiting for burning fossil fuels, a movement capable of really pushing all the reforms and all the necessary measures to really shift away from fossil fuels. And that, as crazy as may sound, it's happening already. In Germany, 20% of the energy comes from renewable energy. And this is not because Merkel is a good woman. I'm from Spain and I can tell you she's not a good woman at all. The reality is that it's because Germany has probably the strongest environmental movement. And this movement has pushed, together with parties on the left, has put pressure on Merkel to really shift away from carbon. And I think that that's what we need on an international scale. And here in the United States, we are seeing already how the big oil companies are trying to divide the movement, right? And claiming that we need fossil fuel in order to make jobs. And the reality is, like, what we should be pointing, it's putting forward a program that can unite the left. As Andrew was saying, that can unite indigenous people, that can unite the people that live in these coal factories. We should be pointing to the incredibly dangerous and horrible working conditions of the people working in these oil refineries. And we have, early this year, these strikes led by the United Steelworkers, of workers striking against the unsafe safety conditions of the oil refineries. And I think we should point out how many new jobs we could generate by investing in renewable energy. And I think that this is the key, united the organized labor movement with the environmental movement in order to build a really strong force capable of pushing all these reforms. And I think that it's really important to point that last year in the climate march here in New York, there were 75 unions marching with the environmental movement. And I think this is the way. But I think that the last thing that the left should say is that as important as it is to build a movement, the reality is, like, under this system, any reform that we win, it's limited. And putting the example of Germany that I was mentioning before, Germany, despite of being in the midst of this shift towards renewable energy, Germany, year after year, keeps increasing its carbon emissions. And this is because Merkel has not been able to really break with the German coal industry, which is one of the strongest. And it's allowing these companies to dig up the coal in Germany. And I think that that's what we should learn from the last decades of human history, that under capitalism, every reform that we win, from the Clean Air Act of Nixon to the 8 hours working day, anything is partial, full of loopholes, and temporary. So I think that if we really want to tackle the problem of global warming once for all, and if we really want to build a symbiotic relation with the planet in which both nature and humans can benefit, we cannot stop in reforming the system, although I agree that it has to be the first stage. But as long as we allow the 1%, this capitalist class, to keep in power and take the decisions of how our society is run, and be able to run the society for their profits and not for the common benefit, as long as that happens, we won't be able to solve the problem. And I think that in the face of most of the problems that humanity is facing right now, the reality is like the solution. It's system change. It's really a revolution. And we should start by taking under public ownership the 500 companies that dominate United States economy. And with doing that, we can redirect the resources of all these companies, of all the society, to invest in green projects and giving work to people and really fulfill the necessity of humans. We need to, the 99%, the working class, all those that are not benefiting from burning fossil fuels, to really start taking the decision and start controlling the way in which society produces. We need to democratically and collectively control the society, and that's socialism. So I want to finish with this. I think that capitalism has allowed the development of technology and science till a point in which a renewable energy future is possible. But I think that today it has outlived the usefulness for society. I think that the destruction of nature that we are seeing today, the growing levels of inequality, the global crisis of war and terrorism that we saw in Paris a few weeks ago, all those are symptoms of a decaying system, of the parasitic nature of capitalism, always growing, growing, growing more in order to look for more profits. It is time that humanity gives the next leap forward in its evolution. It is time that we jump to the next stage that would be democratically controlled society or socialism. It's time to put all the knowledge and technology of humanity to serve the millions and not the millionaires. And this will require a revolution, like my comrade Sam Ashawant, recently elected city council member, said. We have a tremendous opportunity, brothers and sisters. Opportunity that has not happened in previous times. This system is in deep crisis. People all over the world is looking for alternatives. Alternatives to the climate degradation of capitalism and the wars and starvation that this system is producing. We have a tremendous opportunity to rebuild the struggle, the fighting movement that can defeat capitalism and that will allow us once for all to build an egalitarian society where there is not other reason that satisfy our own needs. And in these conditions, every human life, every animal life, every plant life, and the very planet that we call home could be protected.
Thank you. I'm gonna just raise a couple of things. Hopefully it'll be fruitful and then leave some time for responding to one another. 3 minutes, I think, would be good. 3 to 4 okay. minutes would be good. Well, first I wanted to read from an article that just came out from the New York Times about the reports, actually, on the recent climate talks in Paris. And it's a slightly lengthy quote, but if you will allow me, because I think it speaks directly to the things that we've been talking about today. So the New York Times is quoting Mark Jacobson, an engineer at Stanford University, who has drawn attention to a finding that the entire world could operate on 100% renewable power by 2015. So, quote, yet such scenarios...
2015, Ben?
Sorry, 2015. I said 2015. Okay. I'm being very optimistic.
You have 3 weeks.
Yeah,
you
got 30 days.
All right, so New York Times says, yet such scenarios would involve an extraordinary push. Dr. Jacobson's plans require, among many other actions, that 156,000 wind turbines be built off the American coast in the next 35 years, and twice as many on land. In 20 years of effort, European countries have managed to build about 3,000 offshore turbines. In an interview, Dr. Jacobson cited a scientific paper that calculated the oil and gas industry that has been building 50,000 new wells a year in North America since 2000. Each of these, he said, is as complicated as erecting a wind turbine, and building tens of thousands of turbines a year would be well within the nation's industrial capacity. Quote, we think it's technically and economically feasible, Dr. Jacobson said. Quote, it ultimately does come down to political will. If people don't want to do it, it's not going to happen by itself. Dr. Jacobson has often cited the United States mobilization during World War II as an example of what can be done by a determined society. But to some other experts, that very argument speaks to the political and economic impracticability of his plans. I just don't see a World War II-style mobilization happening for anything other than a world war, said Jesse Jenkins, an energy and analyst at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're not going to do that. So the question is, what are we going to do? So I wanted to raise that because I think some of the differences between the panelists are on what should we do on, you know, about climate change. So briefly, I think just, you know, to interject a couple of thoughts here, maybe some of the differences obviously are on this question of reform and revolution. I think that one of the ways in which Platypus members like to raise this question is, what would it mean to have revolutionary reforms? Or what would it mean to have reforms that have as an end goal a revolutionary society? The other thing is how we can imagine the lessons of the history of the left. So one of the questions that I didn't hear a lot of response to, and maybe we can work it out through the Q&A, is what can be learned from the last 80 years from the left? Meaning we're you know, we have a history of the left dealing with environmental issues, and we need stories, as Andrew Newton said, we need stories to kind of explain to ourselves what we're going to do. And so what are the historical lessons? I'm just going to read briefly the question. So from Naomi Klein, the widespread awareness of climate change in 1988 couldn't have come at a worse time. Is the only missed political opportunity? Is this the only missed political opportunity for addressing this problem in the 20th century? Clearly, there was a broad mobilization around environmental issues that coincided with the 1960s New Left, but these discontents were ultimately integrated into the state by the right. For example, Nixon and the 1970 Clean Air Act. Subsequent attempts to connect environmental issues with labor movements around occupational health and safety have also failed. Would the course of climate change be different if the labor movement, for example, had embraced environmentalism? Were the opportunities for left environmentalism before World War II? If so, what were they? And why did all these attempts fail? And how might these failures inform the way we move forward in the present? So I will leave 3 to 4 minutes for response. And sure, let's just go in the same order,
okay,
and
good.
Then we'll have some Q&A.
Yeah, okay, so it's going to be exciting. I can't cover all the points, but Christian addressed what I said specifically, and I want to address pretty much this through what he said, because I think there would be a seeming dissonance between us, which I think is more a matter of the way words are used in this matter, in this regard, because the, and it is the question of reform versus revolution, but actually, I had no time to talk about what eco-socialism is, and we have a fairly developed set of ideas, but one point is, clearly, you do not disregard any insult to the planetary ecology. You find out what has to be done about it, and you do it. But in doing it, you don't do it in the spirit, which is the inner meaning of reform, but rather, and I strongly agree with what Cora said about the necessity of revolution here, but there's another term which we like to use, and I think it's very helpful, and that's called prefiguration. That is to say, you do make a change in the here and now because we can't just fly by flapping our arms. We are always limited, but we have an imagination which is capable of envisioning and seeing, looking forward with what we're doing. So the point is that the germ, the nucleus of the new society appears in the efforts to change the old one. But you have to have that consciousness. When you're doing it, you have to really care about it. And I think we're selling ourselves short in this respect, that the climate action movements, climate justice movements, have been enormously effective, actually. They've been amazing. They stopped the pipeline, and more or less. But most people don't get it. We have actually slowed down carbon emissions. The last 2 years, mm-hmm. they've dropped considerably. And you have to take a lot of credit for that with the activism, which is generational. But the point is not to see that, oh, well, we now have slowed down the carbon emissions so we can have cars again and all the other things we really want. But rather, no, what we did this by moving in mass and connecting ourselves and building new forms of relationship, and that this is the goal of our generation. This, we're thrown into history at this time. Not me, I'm old now, but the younger people coming up. This is your moment in history, and you're going to build something. But you shouldn't think of it as a reform, but rather an anticipation of a transformed society. And that's what you can do, because we are living in this turning point where we must recognize that the whole capitalist system is this monumental delusion that's been going on for centuries and is now capable of being thrown aside, because we have so much science that we didn't have back then, we have so many new capabilities, and we have already this danger that's massing all around. So I want to emphasize that prefiguration, which is a term that has to be developed a lot further than I can do now, is the way to go. Don't think in terms of reforms, but of building and moving towards a future. I want to say one last thing. We have several publications. One of them is a journal called Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. I have four recent issues here, too. This is the September 2015 issue. There's an article in this called An Eco-Socialist Horizon. That's why I call it a horizon. But even the notion of horizon is, you know, you can't, you're not at eco-socialism, but it's on the horizon and you can move towards the horizon. You can envision it, you can imagine it. But there's a man, two people are key people, David Schwarzman, who's actually a geochemist, and Quincy Saul, who's away, and he's very active in Venezuela, but he'll be back in a week or so. I work closely with both of these. And Schwarzman is very clear that we can have a carbon-free energy system, but only if we have it in the interest of a communist society. We cannot have a carbon-free system under capitalist relations for many, many reasons. And there's an article here, because they work a lot with Venezuela, and anyone can have this issue, it's free, although it's ordinarily not, an eco-socialist horizon for Venezuela, a solar communist horizon for the world, solar communist. So the solar transformation is a transformation towards communism. And one thing, Pam,
because
in terms of reform and all that, 80 years, I was wondering why not go back to 95 years? Why not go back to the Soviet Union? When the Soviet Union managed finally to kick out the White Russians for a while, Lenin embarked upon a process of totally transforming the relationships of humanity and nature. And so most people don't know about this because it's all buried under anti-Soviet propaganda. It was eventually crushed under Stalin. Okay, you understand it. But for about 10 years, they did things, it's written up in various books, that were way advanced of even what we're doing now in terms of thinking about new forms of way of living and in terms of nature as a dynamic, active force. You really should look at that, because it doesn't fit our prejudices about Soviet stasis and all. It wasn't at all that way in the 20s. It's amazing. No, learn about that. Also, learn about what Cuba did after 1990. That's another story.
Thank you.
So, I guess what I see the main problem. One of the main problems we face is cynicism. So what I have been trying to do in these comments this evening and generally over the last couple of years is make a credible case for getting out of this impending apocalypse of runaway climate change. And I think that that's really important, because otherwise people just detach. And that's when I am making the case for reform and buying time and breaking out climate change is a subset of the overall ecological crisis, it's with that in mind, which is that I think that the demobilization and the disorientation of the left, particularly in this country, but in many other places as well, has a lot to do with a kind of rational cynicism. And people do the math. They learn like what science says. They kind of look at the institutions. They see the number of cops. They see like, you know, how well organized 1% is, how like, you know, all, you know, not to be mean to our side, but, you know, then they'd see how like, you know, unorganized our side is, even though we're making great strides and taking great risks. And then they think, well, you know, logically, you know, this isn't going to work out, you know, so forget it. So the main thing that I'm trying to do to combat that is say, no, it's actually, it is possible. And not just like invoking notions, but like concrete institutions, right? We've got the law, it's the Clean Air Act. We've got the budget. We've got, you know, public sector, private sector, you know, lay it out so people actually feel then responsible to engage politically in real time rather than check out and feel just. In terms of just transition, you know, that phrase was coined by Tony Mizaki, who was a lefty Marxist trade union leader, insurgent trade union leader of the Chemical and Atomic Workers Union, and a, sort of a mentor to Adolf Reed, who I'm sure many of you have read, and Platypus Review did an excellent interview with Adolf Reed. In terms of, you know, regulation, again, trying to defend reform, regulation works. That's, I think, one thing we can learn from the history of the left. I'm old enough to remember when the streams in New England were filthy. I lived most of my life in Vermont and Maine growing up, and the streams were disgusting. They were full of slime. They're now clean. It's incredible. Even the large rivers. Bald eagles have returned. You know, when I was a kid, bald eagles lived in the Rockies and Alaska and in zoos, and now they're commonplace in New England. That's because of these Nixon-era laws, which are prefigurative. What they do, the message of the EPA and the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the laws that the EPA is designed to enforce, the fundamental message is that society has the right and has the power to control and shape the means of production, right, and to control capital. In this case, in specific instances, implies that society has the capacity to direct production. And more practically, the waters are clean and there is really, you know, a tremendous track record, Silent Spring, right? Banning DDT. I mean, bird life is back in the Northeast. So this has to be pointed out and remembered also to fight against cynicism. In terms of, you know, Germany's energy, carbon emissions going up, part of that has to do with the fact that they've also taken their nukes offline, right? And they've done that because they were downwind of Chernobyl. And in the short term, that does involve a little bit of an increase. And hopefully that's going to go down if they keep building out clean energy. So, I don't know, I guess that's all.
Thank you.
Yeah. I saw a bald eagle in Delaware County a month ago.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I mean, I grew up on a river that has long-term PCB pollution that now has northern pike and bald eagles kind of in it. So, I mean, I think that that's an important, you know, lesson that they're, you know, that regulations pursued vigorously. I think, you know, that one of the things, you know, to build on Christian's first, you know, comments, I think, you know, pushing the state to, you know, invest as much, you know, invest the amount of money the state can invest, you know, is a source of mitigation. And the left has been, when the left has been most powerful, you know, in the last 80 years, has been when it's had, you know, deliberate and specific, you know, campaigns. I mean, when I think of the most successful moment of the left in the, since World War II, it's the sit-in movement, right? Where there is a dramatic, deliberate injustice being displayed and a solution being provided. And I think that this is actually, you know, something that the climate justice movement's been really good at pinpointing the right thing, which is preventing infrastructure from being built. Mm-hmm. Like the moment to prevent kind of climate changing entities is before capital gets invested on the ground. If you can prevent a pipeline from being built, that's the protest to make. You, if and preventing that from being built, you know, may keep, you know, some percentage of carbon in the ground, and that, you know, is one kind of, that's an, the challenge of climate change is that the goals, the danger and the goals are only momentarily tangible. Like, they're tangible in moments of catastrophe. They're tangible in Sandy. They're tangible, I mean, they're more and more tangible daily in Miami, right, where, you know, there's routine climate flooding for people.
It'll be gone soon.
Yeah. So, but you know, I think, you know, the, you know, when the left is most powerful is when it's able to target these specific kind of, these specific, you know, projects. And I think the challenge is what happens when you win. Like, the challenge right now is how does the movement fighting Keystone transition to being a movement against fossil fuel development on public lands, which is the next, you know, which is the next target, is blocking oil and gas leasing on public lands. That's a less tangible thing because there's not a, here's Keystone Pipeline, here's where it's going to go, here's who's damaged by it. Public lands are vague and big. So I think, you know, the challenge is to materialize those, you know, materialize those places where that infrastructure is going to go, and to fight to defeat the specific infrastructure that's being, you know, that's being built. I mean, that's, you know, that, and I think, you know, continued success is what, you know, helps build a movement. That Keystone was not built is a tremendous, you know, movement building, has movement building possibilities. But, you know, keeping people engaged in an age of cynicism is the challenge.
Thank you. I mean, I agree that it's necessary to coin concrete reforms in order for engaging people. I completely agree with that. I think that winning reforms is the way that we can build our power. But as I see it, and what I try to explain in my introduction, it's that we can treat the symptoms, right? Or we can cure the root cause of this. And capitalism as it is has a tendency. It's as I put the example, it's a parasite. It grows, and it has the risk to kill the host, right? And I think we see that in the economic system. It's growing, and then it turns out that the very workers that are the consumers don't have job anymore, cannot consume, and that's where we are in this crisis that we are right now. And I think that with nature is exactly the same. And I agree we can win reforms and we can stop and gain time, and that would be great. But the reality is, like, if we don't start planning the economy, if we don't start putting science at the service of the society, other things will come. We have Monsanto there, for instance. If we may win and shift towards renewable energy, but then Monsanto, with all his transgenic, may screw up all our ecosystem. And if we really want to change and make a planet, I mean, a relation of humans and planet that can really ensure that we are living for a while, I think that we really need to think on revolution. And I think that we need to use these reforms to really start thinking on the bigger picture, right? And I think that exactly what we can learn from the last 80 years of the left is that all the reforms had been ineffective, had been rolled back because of the ideology that had both the labor movement that was pushing for reforms that we have lost today almost completely, and also in the environmental movement, because they were, again, reducing the impact but not really introducing plan into how do we produce as a society, into how we generate our resources. And again, just to finish, I think that we need to use reforms to point concrete demands that we can win. And as we win these demands, I think that we also build our power. We start feeling more confident and really start building structures that would allow really to make a big change in the system, a big revolution.
Thank you. Okay. At this point, thank you to all of our panelists for your thoughtful opening remarks, but we'll like to open it up for some questions from the audience. And since we don't have a mobile mic, I'm just going to repeat your questions really briefly for the audio recording. Questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm from Edward Day West. I've been
So if I can just briefly try to summarize for the reporting, the question is that there's scientific knowledge of all of this available, there's all of this available knowledge as to what's happening in the world, and yet there's a problem of political will. Is that, did I sum up your question?
I guess what continues to not change is that in terms of international politics, hydrocarbons still hold, are kind of central and are fundamental to I guess, like, superpower relations and conflicts.
I'm going to take a question at a time, and not everyone has to answer every single question, I think, so we can get it rolling. But if anybody likes to hop on this one, otherwise I can take another one. Okay?
Just a very quick one. Right. David Schwartzman, who I mentioned earlier, he's a retired geochemist. He believes that we are going to need hydrocarbon fuel for the foreseeable future, because you need two things. You need fuel to build solar panels, and you can't just conjure them out of themselves, or the windmills. And so there has to be an interim period when hydrocarbon fuels are used. Also, it's necessary, and this is a larger point that we should pick up. This is for the whole planet. We're not just talking about industrial societies here. We're talking about the whole Earth. And the whole Earth, it consists of billions of people, many of whom are on subsistence economies and are in desperate shape. And we cannot consign them to total impoverishment. So there has to be some use of the fuel that already exists to bring up the level so they have pumps for their water and so forth, you know, that they can get. Otherwise, you're just abandoning them. So whatever you call the long-term result, if it's going to be a worthwhile life, it has to be a worthwhile life for everybody. And to do that, you have to have some useful value of the existing fuels while their replacements are being built.
Anybody else? Shall I take another question? Yeah.
I mean, I would say that if we just think, for instance, why United States went to Iraq, right? It was for controlling a very precious resource. And because of that, it has led to a bigger and bigger conflict, as we see right now in the Middle East. And I think that this is basically based on the necessity of corporations and the countries they belong to compete against each other, right? If I get Iraq first and I get oil, I can produce cheaper and I can compete out my rivals. I think that if we start thinking on renewable energy, the first point of renewable energy, it's much more decentralized, right? You could have sun, geothermal energy, or wind everywhere. But even more, I think that what is important is, like, if we really remove the necessity of making more profit, the necessity of being more competitive, right, then there is no reason, really, to have all these conflicts over, positions and resources. So that's how I believe, you know, that really things in a world where there is not a small minority controlling the rest of us for their own profits, but actually all of us deciding how to do, can really change this situation.
Take another question.
I just want to say, I think that Cora's point about the problem of reform is really important. And I think specifically with respect to something that Andrew brought up, which is exporting catastrophe. And so, I mean, the other day I was talking to a man who grew up in a small Indian village, and he was telling me about how, as a result of DDT being banned, stocks of it ended up in places like his village, right? So I guess that raises the question of, I mean, I do agree that it's important to have specific goals, and yet how does the left deal with this problem of reforms being won, and yet it seems to shift a problem, you know, it seems to shift things potentially rather than deal with them head on. And so I guess the problem then is how does the left, you know, address this, what is actually, a far more complex and sort of globally expansive problem beyond sort of stopping holes or beyond prevention?
Okay. Yeah.
It seems to me that the problem is how does the left build power, right? And not like, what, gee, if we had enough power to do that, what would we do? That you know, it would be clear. It would be like, you can't use these methods in industry, and you can't take the plant to China, you know? And the doors are open, and we inspect and everything. And if, you know, I mean, ultimately, you would hope that it would be like, this plant no longer operates to maximize profit, but to meet public good. But in the interim, if we're talking about transformative reforms, you know, there would be reforms that controlled the means of production, even if they were privately owned, to a significant extent to prevent that. I mean, part of one of the things that fueled deindustrialization, you're right, is tough EPA regulations, right? That and union wages, these are all reasons to go somewhere else, abuse people and abuse the environment. And why didn't the left stop that? Not because it didn't think of it or decided not to, but because it didn't have the power to, you know? And so that's one of our core problems, right? It's like building power, overcoming cynicism, coming up with real strategies, winning things that are meaningful, getting beyond an obsession with speech and symbols, and really starting to build power. And I think that a lot of you point to very important problems, but I think they would actually be easy to deal with if we had the power to control the institutions, firms that were doing that kind of stuff.
This is a very interesting panel, and bringing up the issue of reform versus revolution. No one's really talking about how we create a revolution, but how do we move people forward? So one of the questions that I think all of you and probably everyone here addresses is the question of how do we mobilize people? How do we get people to respond to the crisis? And it will happen, because as the crisis heats up, literally and figuratively, will start moving. And when, you know, whatever we're learning in our classrooms, and I've taught at a university for 42 years, it ain't nothing as like what you're going to learn in the streets. And what people learn when they're in motion, not just in the street, but in discussion and in creating alternative institutions, that will be part of the transformation. And also understanding that we have to be activists our whole lives, not just a teeny little slice of our lives, because we're not going to reality. We will be facing, we won't have our lives versus we're going to be activists. So I think that's going to be the choice ahead of us. I think right now, and I agree that the environmental movement is really shaping up and becoming a global movement that talks to itself and to others and has the capacity for real, real change, whether it's strictly reform or beyond that. People aren't going to move to socialism unless they think that they can affect change. But I just want to reflect on one meeting that I went to, and I'd like you to respond to it. Went to a meeting of second and third level union leadership in the city, and most of the people in the room were black, and they were talking about how do we get our union members and community people to look at Black Lives Matter, the fight for 15, and climate change together. Now, that's a transformative package. And we're at this crisis moment. I mean, the sense of inequality, the sense of discrimination and oppression, and what's facing us in terms of climate, I think it's possible to put those ideas together and to really make some transformation. So I'd like you to respond to what you see as that new possibility of a new set of ideas emerging.
So just for the sake of the recording, the question being, how do we bring all of this new movement ideas together? Is this are we in a current state of possibility, perhaps, or not?
I think that that to touch a little bit in what you started about how do we mobilize people, I think that the conditions are mobilizing people. I think that we are seeing all over the world now people getting up and really standing. I think the question is how we keep them moving, right? Because the problem is like yeah, we try certain things and then we are defeated and then we stop. Like you see Syriza, you see even the Black Lives Matter movement goes like in spots. And I think that that's a tricky question, and I think that requires the left to really learn the lessons from the past, to really understand who is the enemy that we are facing, which tactics are using to divide us. And I think that the last thing that you're bringing is extremely important, really. How can we join Fight for 15, BLM, environment, all the different struggles that we are seeing, right? And I think that's actually the key of the whole story. And I, from my point of view, how we link it is through capitalism. The reality is like all these struggles stem from the reality of having a system that is just for benefiting a few. That's why you have racism. That's why racism was not stopped, because there is a benefit in the system on keeping a population undermined. That's why you don't have a decent minimum wage, because having a higher minimum wage would mean less profits for the people up. And as I have explained, that's why you have environmental crisis. So I think that the way in which we have to move forward is in all these movements to really start trying to take these conclusions about the systemic nature of the problem. And that's how we can really build a struggle together, which eventually would allow us to really change society.
Yeah, and just to build on that, I think that we are in a moment where a kind of systemic critique is available in a way that it hasn't been since the 70s, it would be my kind of, you know, if you had to say when was it last available? I mean, I think that, you know, the combination of those three, you know, of those three movements, right, really points to a kind of, you know, to a kind of understanding of a deep, you know, of a deep corruption that is kind of longstanding in, you know, in terms of, you know, I mean, it's possible now to talk in public about America being a white supremacist nation. Like, that was not, you know, that was not a thing that you could say publicly and be, you know, taken, you know, and be taken seriously. Now that is something that you can really say and have it appear not only, you know, on the left, but in the Atlantic Monthly. You know, you can talk about the corruption of capitalism in, you know, in public in a way post Occupy Wall Street that you couldn't before. You can talk, you know.
But isn't that, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
just
no.
Quickly
yeah.
respond, like, isn't one of the reasons for that is because the left had power before, and so when you said those things out loud in public, they had a real weight behind them, they had a real force, whereas today, like, left thinking is mostly academicized. And so when you say these things, it's not as if the government is looking to run off, that the revolution is coming, but I don't know.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, I think that what is coming is unknown. Right. I mean, I think that there is, you know, that these exist, you know, that these movements exist, you know, suggests there's an opportunity for someone to propose a solution, and think about ways to link, you know, climate, capitalism, and racism together in, you know, in new ways. And I think that that's available now in a way that it hasn't been in, you know, in quite some time.
Also, you know, history moves on, and there is a change in the center of gravity, you might say. I mean, in the 19th century, first epoch socialism was very much concerned with the power of labor at the workplace. And meanwhile, lots of things were happening which somehow didn't get built into it. But now, like, these people in urban settings are having to deal with systemic pollution. They're having to deal with, you know, the fumes from the traffic and so forth. They have to deal with the toxic food that they're being forced to eat and so forth. And so that is that, in other words, the center of gravity now increasingly becomes not the coherence of labor, although that's not to be discarded, but rather the integrity of life. I mean, mm-hmm. life is the the dominant term of our ecological moment, because it's so threatened. This also has tremendous implications for gender. And we should have a much deeper, wider conversation about this. Because first epoch socialism said, well, comes the revolution, women will be empowered. But, you know, great. But no, now what you have is in almost every instance, the spontaneously arising rebellions are led by women. You now have a much more active principle, which has to be built into the entire way the world is seen and indeed transformed. And this is epochal. I mean, there's never been a time since the primitive communism where there is this powerful possibility for female rising into positions of authority that are rationally given. So these are all the things that you build on as history unfolds and provides a never-ending set of possibilities.
I'm going to take two questions and then have you back, because if we're running a little in time, I want to be sure to get a couple. So I know you've had your hand up for a while. And then Jamie?
Cool. So I wanted to kind of jump off of something you said earlier, Joel, about the plastic bottle. And
I'm sorry?
The plastic bottle.
Yes.
And kind of the things we don't notice. And then, Christian, what you're saying about sort of tangible, practical reform. So first, just a quick comment. I was at the climate change march a year ago.
Yeah.
And I left really frustrated because I felt as if all those people who had been marching, if they'd maybe made a decision like changing their bank account to an ecologically responsible bank,
yeah.
that tangible impact or something like
yeah,
that,
yeah,
just
yeah.
things that you have a volume of people, the kinds of decisions you
yeah.
could do besides walking somewhere that would have consequences, there's so many possibilities that I didn't feel
yeah.
like you even really came up. And so I guess the question I have is along the lines of, are there problems with lack of imagination? Things that come to mind, for example, are like you can make an airplane entirely out of hemp, right? Or you can talk about how public transportation was systematically destroyed. You can talk about how the war on drugs
yeah.
and the prohibition
yeah.
and the racial undertones of something like Harry Altslinger, demonizing cannabis leads to deforestation, and how that connects to how Indonesia's on fire. And
right.
really seeing all these kinds of connections that, I think that also it's just you of how we're saying that climate change is also very much a subset of these larger issues of how we relate to the environment in general. And I think also kind of like someone like John Perkins, who went from being much more in just an economic space
to hitman.
Going into shamanism and
yeah.
going into supporting indigenous communities in ayahuasca and all these different
yeah.
kinds of ways in which you're not
yeah.
just looking at the problem in terms of politics or
right.
the state, and those are important conversations,
yeah.
but can the ideological constraints become limiting and say, well, maybe what are the possibilities, what are the opportunities that come from completely shifting the conversation and thinking in really, really different
right.
ways, and how to maybe open that up a little bit.
Thank you. Jamie.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I'm from Platypus. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about, so I think that there has been a kind of conflict or tension in left eco-politics insofar as they address societal level of production, which is so this reflection upon the fact that rampant kind of unconscious productivity and technological production has gotten us into this kind of shitty situation. So there are kind of two, be really basic about it, two reactions. One, which is change production. In other words, further kind of innovation versus no more production, or something more along the lines of reaction or austerity or this sort of thing. So I wonder what you think about in trying to kind of build a movement that could adequately address climate crisis today. Do you see this tension potentially being a problem for a unified left movement? And or is there a tension between preservation and transformation,
mm-hmm.
and if so, which one
do you think? Just quickly for the recording, so if I can briefly summarize this issue of maybe moving away from the hairy ideological problems of political transformation and something else, or a question mark, or what would that mean if people took it onto their own
mm-hmm.
hands to make some changes on a mass scale. And then second, this tension between preservation and transformation and the left's relation to technology and productivity. Any takers?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of gets at what I said at the beginning, that we're facing the end of a whole mode of production, okay? And so, and once you absorb that and sort of shake it loose a little bit, you say, wait, the whole world is opening up. We've got to really, we have to rebuild the earth. And this is literally the most revolutionary moment in the entire history of the human species. There is no possibility of life without production for humanity. That's our species signature. You know, that's why you get the big brain and the opposable thumb and the hand-eye coordination and things like that, and the loss of instincts and stuff. So you have to make your own. We make the world. But suddenly you realize, not suddenly, but slowly, fitfully, in crisis, you realize, wait a second. You said it. This is a shitty world we live in. It's crap. And you know, Gina said it beautifully, you know, face it. This is a decaying, dying mode of production. And the question is, once you can get your head around it, it's inspiring. What an incredible opportunity. You know, not opportunism, but you know, just an opportunity that has to be taken collectively. You know, and building new forms of relationship. You know, and you know, the probably the most radical, most important things going on in the world are some of these indigenous communities, like the Zapatistas. You know, these are people who create new forms of power outside of the state. You know, of course, the state's always trying to batter them, and human beings are always going to be very, you know, complex. You know, a lot of weirdness. Okay, that's fine. That makes it much more interesting. But I sense that happening in the questions here. Hey, wait, this old world is revealing. We're inheriting this dying civilization. There's no other word for it. And we have to build a new one.
In terms of, one question sort of hinted at degrowth. I don't think that is, if that's really what you're talking about. I mean, degrowth, I think that's kind of silly politics, you know. I mean, that's generally like Herman Daly, these kind of people, nice people, but, you know, they think you can sort of trick capitalism into right. not growing by getting the price mechanism right, price signal right.
Lots of luck.
Yeah. A steady state economy would have to be a socialist economy. In terms of the political imagination, I see the biggest problem of political imagination as the infusion of neoliberal common sense and sensibilities and categories into the left imagination. So the idea, I mean, no offense, but I mean, your suggestion, the idea that there's such a thing, is there a green bank, or is there some sort of form of investment that would be carbon neutral? I don't know how you invest in an economy where the entire thing runs on fossil fuels, even if there's a growing clean tech sector, where your capital is clean. I think that's one of the main myths, right, that capital, financial capital, has a certain type of agency, which is totally, you know, one of the central fantasies of neoliberalism. And the key problem, as I see it, in terms of what neoliberalism has done to the left imagination, is that it has completely disappeared the state. Like, the state doesn't even exist. It's not even there to be hated or fought over. It's just like, why would you consider the state? What does the state do? Well, it enforces every single property relation in the society, right? Behind every piece of property is the promise that if you violate that rule, the state will come and get you and put you in jail. And if you resist, they'll kill you, you know, and they have the right, and it's very clear, right? And so it's central to the whole thing. It is underneath it all. That is where it all resides. You know, when push comes to shove, violence is what governs society. And part of what reforming capitalism frequently to save it from itself has involved is using that power, the power of government, the power of the state, to say, look, here you will not dump your toxic garbage in the water. And there will be consequences if you do, capital. Now, obviously, generally, most of state violence, regulation, governmentality, et cetera, is, you know, about controlling not capital, but the people as a whole. But there is also an element in the reproduction of the society that involves state power threatening and containing and shaping capital. And that, I think, has just completely dropped out of the left imagination. And particularly in the environmental movement, you hear all sorts of stuff about politics are broken, government is broken. And that's, you know, an example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I can speak up.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Better now.
I agree that there, it's you have to understand how capital exists and moves. But you said earlier, Christian, that society has the capacity to direct production and control capital. That you have to force capital to move off fossil fuels. Regulation works. And regulations pursued vigorously. But I think we're looking to the past and seeing regulations of streams and mistaking that, like a particular, for universal. Like, I want to see the regulation that, and I appreciate what Cora said about that countries will abhor disadvantage, and companies will abhor disadvantage. They cannot tolerate disadvantage. So how do you regulate the system such that trillions of dollars in this infrastructure that companies have invested in oil wells and pipelines and everything, how do you regulate it such that it is profitable for them? I mean, the accumulation of capital is on the sidelines, not because they don't want to work or, you know, there's some like strike of capital just for the hell of it. It's because it's not profitable. They're not seeing it as being profitable for them. I think Marxists get a bad rap for being economic determinists, but what I'm hearing so much on the left, and I appreciate Platypus bringing together a bunch of different panels, and I'd recommend people go to, there's a video of the one in Chicago that was just posted last night. And Peter Hughes talked about something that was only mentioned, you know, in passing once, the idea of value production. I think there's a risk of political determinism on much of what I see on the left. Because it's been a while since I read Capital. One of the lessons I thought is that you unleash this thing, you create this thing, or capitalists direct this thing, but they're also bit players in the role. They've unleashed the thing that the sorcerer can't control, right? So how are we supposed to control capital within capitalism? That's the question.
All right, second question.
Yeah. Well, first of all, some people have said that talk spoke about capitalism. People are talking about capitalism as a source of all evil, destruction of environment, and stuff like that. Obviously, destruction of the environment started long before capitalism, even prehistorical times, much of Southeastern Europe, Middle East, and North
Okay, again, for the sake of the recording, I know a lot of things were said, but if I could just try to sum it up. So this problem of trying to control capitalism while still being inside capitalism, there was this issue of that maybe we're not considering the problem of value and the creation of value enough. That was one. Two, this issue of capitalism itself being ambivalent towards the environment, not anti-environment, but rather just trying to make a profit. And how does the left then have a response against both the kind of inequalities that would be reproduced in a more environmentally justice-based society, while at the same time fighting against economic inequality? Could we start on the other side this time and go around?
Okay, I have a vehement point I want to make at some point.
No worry, you'll get to it. Okay, Cor.
Okay, so I start by the last question. So I think, I agree that it's not that capitalism has a specific interest of destroying nature. I think it's basically under capitalism, everything becomes a commodity, right? Human labor becomes a commodity, nature becomes a commodity, and as such, they are exploited for the profits. And I think that, it's true that humans have been interacted with nature since the very beginning that we appear on Earth. And that's a reality of any other organism. The problem, I think, is like we've never seen our interaction with nature from the point of view of what consequences are they going to have. And in particular in capitalism, because it's such a level of production and it requires to grow, as never in any other system before. That's where the level of environmental destruction under capitalism, it's greatest than any other time on Earth. And I think that regarding how do we approach really the social impact that can have a shift towards renewable energy, I think that we need to really understand how price is put under capitalism. The reality is that most of the price we are paying is not really what it costs to produce. It's what it costs to pay the CEO of the company that it's producing it. I mean, if you really analyze, and that's where they can make sales whenever they want, that's when they can change prices whenever they want. The reality is like, if we remove from the equation the humongous profits that the big corporations needs to take for themselves, there's no need to really invest or increase the price of things. So I think that I don't think that we can really make a plan directly of how would it be, but I think the question is really to integrate, as we were talking before, all the different movements, right? And I think that if we start planning how we are producing, trying to analyze and putting science into that planification, trying to analyze what consequences are here, what consequences are there, we can collectively really decide how we can produce and organize our economy in a way in which we decrease the impact of social and environmental.
Yeah, I have a couple points that I think are blending between the two questions. So I think while there have been many human-caused ecological changes, we are in a different moment. Like the science is clear that this is a categorically different kind of human-generated ecological transformation. So, Elizabeth Kolbert has a very fascinating, but I think kind of wrong-headed book called The Sixth Extinction that, you know, argues that human beings are by their nature an extinctive species, and kind of dating back to the kind of way that Homo sapiens killed off Neanderthals and kind of draws, you know, a sixth extinctive era that we're living in now related to the emergence of Homo sapiens. It's a marvelous book. I think it read in a moment of climate change doesn't do helpful work. Second, I think there's no, the kind of political determinism, economic determinism question is, there's no economy absent the state right now. And if we think about, what's the major project of the American state since World War II? One of them is certainly cheap energy as a central state project. I think that that's where, the real danger of the social ecological dimension is that climate change is so easily demagogued after policies are put in place. There is such a political opportunity to demagogue any kind of climate, you know, change legislation on the accusation that this is making, you know, this is making energy more expensive. And I think what's really attendant is the investment of vast amounts of state money into renewable fuels to prevent that demagogic, you know, that, you know, I mean, that this is why this is in part why the Republicans are so adamantly, you know, fighting against climate. They're both, you know, because, you know, they're even more than the Democrats bought off by, you know, by the fossil fuel industries, but also to preserve the opportunity to demagogue, you know, to demagogue climate change in the next election. So I, you know, the unfortunately, public, you know, state dollars will have to go toward maintaining cheap energy as a political reality. And I think that you know, that is part of, you know, that is part of the American political economy, and to try to disaggregate those into a kind of political or economic, you know, for me, they're so kind of interdependent, and the economics of it are so state created that they can't be kind of, you know, that they can't be pulled apart.
When I was saying that, you know, regulation works, I'm not saying everything can be, you know, reformed out of existence. I wasn't suggesting that just, you know, reforms alone will undo the value relation. But what I was saying was that it can buy time, specifically in relation to carbon, in relationship to climate change, right? That we have to take that problem seriously, and it's distinct, it's a subset, it doesn't actually deal with the problem that you brought up. I mean, you brought up the larger and deeper problem, which we're never going to get to if we don't mitigate emissions. And that in and of itself is just a massive, massive task that's really hard to credibly imagine how we could deal with it. So, and in terms of cost, you know, I think this is something that is important to question, this idea of like costs are bad. I mean, one party's cost is another party's income. Also, capital only innovates in the face of barriers, you know? I mean, you think about they never describe Christmas as too costly, right? They're like, oh, Christmas is going to cost so much money this year. Like, hey, great, it's going to be a lot of shopping, right? So this idea that that the cost of this is too much, I think, is wrong in human terms, but also actually even for capital. I mean, in many ways, it wouldn't be good for the environment because of the ultimate throughput that would come from a long economic boom, but you could make the case that the thing the capital needs more than anything else is for the fossil fuel industry to be euthanized, because that would unleash a whole new long wave of accumulation that would have technological innovation, it would have openings for the left to demand rising wages, and then, you know, everybody would want to have a catfish sandwich, and all, you know, the last mangrove would be turned into a shrimp farm. But you can definitely make the economic case that actually what capital needs more than anything are like costs, and the threat of inflation, the threat to accumulated capital, to force reinvestment, to force innovation. And you know, so I wouldn't be, I'm not so afraid of the implied costs of the energy transition.
I think I'm a sort of an isolate here. That's okay. I'm happy with that. I guess we're coming to an end anyhow. So this set of interventions are ones I substantially don't agree with. So I'm just, although in different ways and different levels. First of all, Marx says that capital is not a thing, but a social production relationship. You can look it up. And it's very important. Jörg Zimmel, mm-hmm. in The Philosophy of Money, says money does not correspond to anything in the real world. It is only an idea in the mind of a creature, namely us. Okay. There is no substantive reality for capital or money. These are created for us. There is no, the idea that there is no economy.
There's a social reality to it.
Well, yes, but that's That's the point, is to change social reality. There's no economy absent the state, Andrew said. But I can show you a book that says Society Without the State. And these are primitive people. There's no state without a class system. If you have a classless society, you don't need a state, okay? You have people self-directing themselves. Now, obviously, these are very, very weighty matter here, but I just want to emphasize that in any event, the notion that capital is indifferent, is a neutral factor, it's just what you do with it, is one of those perhaps honest intentions with which the road to hell is paved. I mean, that's not the nature of capital. That's not what it's about. It's about inserting money value into ecological relations. But there is no money value in ecological relations. It's just not the way it is. Nature does, as Zimmel points out, the money does not belong to nature. It's something that we construct in order to realize ourselves. When you go back to Marx, you can start now looking at the fetishism of commodities, part in the first chapter of Capital, which is the most difficult part of the whole book, but also the most essential, because that's where he talks about the nature of value. And he says, value, which is what money, secretes itself into, is something that comes from the religious world. It's like the gods we make for ourselves. It's something we believe in, but it's not part of us. We reach towards it. It's a very deep spiritual function. But those are the kinds of functions that can be transformed because they're not essential. They're not built into our biology. They just aren't. We can't do without lungs, and endocrine system and all that. We can do without money, and most certainly can do without capital. And I don't think we get very far if we assume that this entity called capital has a self-existing reality that we somehow have to deal with. I know how hard it is to get rid of, but that's only because human beings can be very, very stuck in their ways, extremely self-destructive, extremely irrational, and so on and so forth. I spent this 300 pages in this book. It's called The Enemy of Nature, and the enemy of nature is capital. Okay, so that's my thesis, and it's spelled out in considerable detail. And I can't say more than that.
Thank you.
Respectfully disagree.
That's perfectly fine. Very welcome. Well, just to wrap up, I think that often, especially among left circles in the United States, there's this emphasis for activism and to move people on the streets, and without any of that,
that's what you said. There should be disagreements.
None of it would be possible. But I think I just want to highlight that all of the issues that we've talked about today have a very real and concrete effect on any kind of political activity one does, whether it be deciding to go to a protest or push for certain reforms or even imagining what a classless society would look like. So thank you very much for expanding that for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
A reception in Kimmel 802, and if you don't know where that is, you can follow some of the people with the platypus pins to the elevators there. There'll be drinks and food, so everyone and anyone is welcome to join.
And can I just say there are a couple of free items and one item for sale?
Lots of free stuff outside on the tables as well. Please feel free to pick up some platypus reviews,
how to
socialist
get
alternative literature, etc.
Yeah.
And in the meantime,
don't rule it out in advance.
Oh no, I haven't. Where the average person is very far away from that.
No, it's
one
true.
Thing we didn't talk about in terms of that. Bernie Sanders is interesting in terms of like your point about an opening. It's like,
but that's an interesting question.
Well, not very far, but like, who would have thought a guy running around calling himself a socialist?
Well, yeah.
I mean,
well, I'll have to say, he lost me when he said that we were travelers.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see why we should pay any attention to a dead communist dictator.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yes. Now that really finished him off.
Yeah, I mean, he's, but, you know, he's,
he had made bad errors before that. He voted for the bombing of Yugoslavia.
Nick,
but I mean, 50 years ago, Bernie Sanders was you know, it was Bill Bradley, not Bernie Sanders.
Right.
That was the, like, you know, and I think that that, like, you know,
well, he's, yeah,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Bernie Sanders is an ambassador.
That's a lot of industry.